Hello and welcome to the American Magazine podcast for the week of August 27th. This week we feature an interview with David Van Bima, who is a former religion reporter for Time Magazine and the author of Mother Teresa, The Life and Works of a Modern Saint. This book has just been published in paperback and is also now available in Spanish. David Van Bima spoke with Associate Editor Kerry Weber.
Hi, David. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Kerry. I'm very pleased to be here.
I wonder if you could start just with telling us a little bit about how this project came about.
Originally, it began because 10 years after Mother Teresa's death, a book came out called Mother Teresa, Come Be My Light, which was the letters that you probably remember that she had been collected from her life that talked about her dark night of the soul. And I wrote a cover for Time magazine about those letters and became fascinated with them as they were part of her whole life, and suggested to Time that they might do a book about her, or rather that I might do a book about her, and did. The book did well, and we're now reprinting it, and I'm especially happy that we're also doing a Spanish language edition of the book for the first time.
Was there something in particular about Mother Teresa that sort of made you fascinated with her personally, that you would want to be the one to write about this?
I think it worked backwards for me. I mean, I became really acquainted with her through those letters, which was somebody, you know, letters of somebody who was having such a terrible time with her faith and with the presence of Jesus, or the absence, really. Then I sort of reverse engineered her life in my head to think, well, look what she was doing, you know, while she was going through all of this. And these two things, which seem so different from one another in some ways, I think made her a more interesting person to me than she had been previously.
You talk a little bit in your book about the idea of sainthood sometimes being described, or in your thoughts, as sort of God flipping a switch. Like, here's your pre-sainthood life, and here's when you really start becoming a saint. But with Mother Teresa, it seemed like maybe a more organic process. Could you talk more about that?
Yeah, that's the way it seemed to me. I mean, you have, you know, Saul becoming Paul, right? And, you know, he's blinded, he falls off the horse and what have you, and he's a totally different person. He was a bad person before. Suddenly he's a saint. And I think that's a very romantic image. I'm not certain that everybody has that image of saints, but it's a powerful one. I think it's very tempting in Mother Teresa's case, especially when you hear that she's Albanian, because you think, well, Albania, to the extent that you know about it, kind of a poor country way over on the east of Eastern Europe. She must have been sort of an unlettered poor girl who then, you know, became this amazing person. And in fact, her family was pretty well off. She lived in Macedonia. Her family was so well known that her family's last name, which I'm not going to attempt to pronounce at the moment, was kind of a byword for generosity in the town where she lived. So they had money, and not only that, but they had this huge heart, this huge generosity. She would go with her mother making a circuit of a lot of the poor people in the area when she was a very little kid, and her mother would, you know, give them alms. And in one case, they visited an alcoholic woman, and they tended her sores. And so, you know, I mean, when I read that, I said, well, in some ways, that's not really too different from what she sort of institutionalized 40-odd years later.
In order to sort of institutionalize that, you have to have a set, not just of the spiritual know-how, the spiritual skills, but of kind of, I don't know if you want to say secular skills, you know, organizational skills, leadership skills, which I think Mother Teresa did and have in spades, as you write about.
Yeah, she would maintain that she didn't have them, and this was a sort of a topic of some amusement to people who knew her and loved her, because she very clearly could have been, you know, the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, but the way that she saw it was that she was making the decisions. Is, you know, one of her handy dandy quotes was one, one, one. So every decision in her head was being made on the fly, according to the needs of the moment. But in fact, all those ones were really extremely well organized. And this, again, you can make the argument goes back to childhood, where she came from a family that did, traded internationally and organized companies and what have you.
Now, another thing that sort of surprised people about Mother Teresa was, as you said, the letters that describe the spiritual dryness. In your research, what did you find out about this period of her life? How do you put it into context for people who only see, you know, the good work and the inspiration that she offered?
Well, what was most remarkable about the period of spiritual dryness was that it lasted for 40 years. It lasted the entire length of her ministry. It set upon her almost from the moment that she started the Missionaries of Charity through to her death, with a couple of months of wow somewhere in the middle of it. But for the most part, it really never let up. And so I think that you have to understand it not as an interregnum or something that came and went away and then allowed her to do her work again, but rather something that she was working with or working in spite of, or somehow in an indirect way that it's hard for us to figure out actually fed her work.
It's sort of the opposite of that sort of conversion moment you were talking about before. And then I guess in a way also becomes another conversion moment, because you have to overcome that to continue with anything.
You could make the case that this was the miracle. If you're looking for dramatic things in Mother Teresa's life, you won't go hungry. You know, I mean, her conversion moment, as it were, what's still celebrated as Inspiration Day, were locutions and visions that she had when she was in her 30s on a train, and there were these, you know, long conversations with Jesus. And it wasn't just, I don't want to give the impression that, you know, she just chugged merrily along from being a good kid to being a good saint. It was go into the houses of the poorest of the poor, and her resisting, and him saying, you know, have you lost your courage? And I mean, it was very, very dramatic. But in some ways, it's almost as dramatic that she should have done subsequently what she did without his presence, because that is really, really, really hard. And that is really, really, really strange.
Yeah, it's interesting to have both of those experiences in one life. This time when she actually literally says that she hears Jesus Christ speaking to her, and then 40 years of nothing. It's just, it doesn't seem like it could happen to the same person in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are spiritual ways to parse it, and I think that, you know, the person who put this book out, that all these letters were in, was her postulator, the guy who's responsible for making the argument that she's a saint. So obviously he has his theological reasons for this, and he sees it as totally consistent. But, you know, I am not a Christian, so I guess I'm allowed to look at other things, and I would suggest the possibility that she was extremely scared of the sin of pride, and that the more she exercised her will, the more difficult it became for her to imagine Jesus totally being on board the same way that he was. Now that's, you know, people are going to really be mad at me for saying that, and it's one of a gazillion possible reasons. But you do look at it and try to figure out why it happened at exactly the same time as the ministry. And, you know, another way to see it is that it was in some ways, and this is what Father Kolodziejczyk would say, it was a grace that was given to her to really share Christ's passion and the abandonment that he experienced in the passion, that is, I mean, given to few people who we also call saints, who are either in there contemplatively or out there in the world doing tremendous things at the same time. And and that was what Brian was basically saying, or one of the things that made her remarkable, was that it was a very deep sharing of the experience of Christ.
Now, in your research, was there something that you found that sort of surprised you most about Mother Teresa, something besides sort of these big revelations that we sort of have all found out about through her letters, or is there something else that really struck you?
I guess I was constantly being surprised. I mean, you know, she had this extremely dry sense of humor. You know, she had just gotten a call from these women who were in some war zone, and she gave them the option to get out of the war zone, and they said they, you know, were going to stay anyway. And she said, okay, call me back when you're dead. You know, I mean, that is, you know, that's tough love. I think I was amazed at the extent to which, in the midst of all these very extreme spiritual acts and struggles, that she was, you know, like your grandmother, you know, a very strong-willed woman who you could understand totally as kind of an earthy person.
No, in her ministry, she did a lot of traveling eventually, you know, and went all over the place from place to place. Do you think that sort of diminished her ability to focus on her original mission, or do you think that it helped her to sort of broaden her focus?
I think she hated traveling. I mean, she hated a lot of the things that we might have thought that she liked when you talk about average celebrities, and she became a celebrity. You know, you talk about the travel, you talk about, you know, meeting powerful people and things like that. I think a part of her really, really did hate that stuff. It was hard for her to do. But at the same time, there was a very strong impetus that comes from those same locutions to sort of spread this. It wasn't just, you know, do it for yourself. It wasn't just do it in Calcutta. It was do it all over the world. And she once said, if there are poor people on the moon, I'm going there. I think that she saw it as necessary. And one of the things that's occurred to me lately, because I've been thinking of it in terms of the saint as companion to the believer, and I think that she went from place to place all the time so that her sisters could stay in one place all the time. That is, she would set up these houses in place after place where the sisters were there. They were there with the poorest of the poor, like every day, to be their companions. And she was running around like a chicken, you know, in order to establish that stability. It's just that she wasn't the one who was providing that immediate stability, and it probably hurt her not to do that.
It hurt her personally in
her
spirituality?
Yeah, I suspect it did. I think it did. I think that she had a very strong drive to connect very personally to the very poor, and I suspect that it was something that she kind of gave up because she the greater goal was to be able to give this to more poor people, and that could only be done if you set up your sisters in all kinds of places.
Mother Teresa's, not just her spiritual life, but what she spoke about in her talks and what she advocated for was not without controversy either, and sometimes she would anger, you know, both the, quote, liberal or conservative groups. Do you see her as a kind of unifying figure in terms of the church, or do you see her as someone who maybe was more divisive?
No, I see her as unifying. I think that she was unifying in part because of the media environment that she was operating within. It was a more monolithic media environment, and also it wasn't quite as, you know, you catch every last thing that the person says and immediately everybody knows it. And I think that, you know, her overarching message was one that everybody could kind of get behind. And also the media outlet, there were only X number of media outlets that were putting it out. But I think that if she were operating now, I think that something that happened to some extent in her later years would probably be operating now, which is that she did take positions on things that are controversial, at least here in the States. I mean, you know, when she won her Nobel Prize, I think that a lot of people were shocked that she gave basically an anti-abortion speech because they didn't really know about that part of her thinking. And that became a larger and larger part. And she also could speak very specifically about things that are kind of, that remain hot button issues or have come up again as hot button issues, because at the time the Vatican was looking into American nuns and she weighed in. And it's not clear exactly who she wrote to. It was probably the cardinal in charge, and said, I still feel the need to turn to you, to beg you to help our religious sisters in the USA to turn to our Holy Father with childlike confidence and love. And when she took flack for that, which she did, for not being supportive enough of the sisters in the States, she just kind of doubled down and said wrote directly to the sisters, do not trust those who have come to your presence with dazzling words about liberty and renovation. They do nothing more than deceive. So if she walked into the LCWR controversy right now, which she might have, and said that, you know, there might be a tendency to see her as a more divisive figure in the church. But living when she did, it was that had less of an opportunity to take over her media profile. And in some ways, I think that's good, because if you look at the balance of what she did, you know, 9/10 of it was not that stuff.
Yeah, it is interesting the way little things become very big things very quickly in the media environment today.
Yeah, I mean, abortion was more than a tenth of her thing.
Sure.
I mean, but there are other smaller things that mm-hmm. would dominate X number of news cycles now.
Today, given that she's not regularly in the media, what does her life mean for us today? You know, we don't see her all the time. We see the sisters occasionally that are part of her order, but she isn't really a regular figure in the media any longer. Should she be? Should we keep her there? What do we hold her up as? You know, what does her life mean right
now? Yeah, I kind of think that we should try to keep her there. I'm not exactly certain how one achieves that. I mean, I think that, you know, I don't know how you do it, but I think that she represented some very specific things. I mean, I like to use the sentence, you know, working with the poor. And every word of that sentence she kind of redefined. As for the poor, she substituted the poorest of the poor. And that's a specific category, and it's a category that carries with it a kind of specific moral imperative. And then for with, she really, really meant with. I mean, she wanted her sisters, and she herself wanted to be with the poor, living their lives, being as poor as they possibly could themselves, like every day of the week. And I'm not saying that this is radically new in the Catholic Church, but she really pushed it extremely hard. And in terms of the word working, we've talked about her organizational savvy and so on. So I think that she represented, and there are people who know more about her than I do, who will probably be able to tell you much more specifically other things that she represented that nobody else sort of brought in front of the world the way that she did. And I think that a lot of people had an opportunity to kind of see that at a distance and to have their consciences vaguely pricked and to think about the poorest of the poor and think, oh, wow, that might be something different. And I wonder what happens when somebody has been dead for a while. The church itself has a means of remembering. The church itself has canonization. You know, it has beatification and canonization, and that's a formalization of remembering somebody for their heroic virtue. But does the population at large who knew her have an opportunity to sort of run that by themselves again? I really hope they do, because I don't think that people like this come around, you know, every 5 years.
Right, there's not an election cycle where we're like, okay, you're the next, exactly. Mother Teresa.
Well, and that's a very, you know, that's a very interesting, and that's something else that I think about. It's sort of, I see her as sort of, it had to do with when I was covering religion most intensely on a sort of a daily or weekly basis. But it seemed to me that there was kind of a Mount Rushmore of public religious icons that included her, included Billy Graham, included John Paul II, and kind of as the junior member, like the junior member of the Avengers or something like that, sure. There was the Dalai Lama, who is like, you know, 10 or 20 years younger than the other ones, but still seemed to me to be part of this pantheon of huge moral religious figures that had a global charisma that went beyond just their faiths. And I don't see the next generation of that. And I find that really fascinating. I don't know who makes up the successor generation. And that makes me question whether actually it does work that way. You know, whether there's something having to do, again, with the media environment that enabled a group of people to attain that kind of prominence in that kind of way, or whether it's something having to do with how polarized our political atmosphere has become here that makes it hard for us to see people that way, or whether it was just sort of, you know, harmonic convergence of people with these remarkable gifts and remarkable histories who all happen to happen at roughly the same time, and the stars won't come into alignment for another 100 years.
Do we have to have that? Do you have to have the big leader to look to in these religious environments? Or is there a sense of everything's becoming more crowdsourced? Well, you know, we'll do this. We'll all be the hero together or whatnot. We'll tweet about it or something.
Well, if I were a good Christian, I would say you could crowdsource all you want, but you better have Jesus. You know? And to a certain extent, I would say that the same thing applies to people who are held up as paradigms in the modern day, that it's not a bad thing to have people who are from among us who represent these virtues that we might aspire to or say something to us about the environment that we live in that we hadn't really thought of because we weren't thinking from that selfless point of view. At the same time, should we really need that? Do we have to have that in order to live, you know, like fulfilled moral lives? Well, I would say theoretically, no, we shouldn't need it all.
So if we're looking for them, where do we go? You know, if you've been thinking about it, where's the next?
Well, Time Magazine's most influential list, I would say, first of
all. Obviously,
you
of
know,
course.
They pop up there. People do pop up. I think that also, I think that there are all these people who are saints or who are exemplary figures of various kinds who are regional, A, or B, who are just not that famous but are somewhat famous. And, you know, if you read your newspapers or if you read your aggregated news, then I think that they'll pop up and you'll see the ones that speak to you. I do think it's possible. I'm not certain it's possible in the same way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you very much, David, for joining us. I really appreciate your insight, and it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Likewise. Thanks a lot.